Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. Let us now praise famous men. Or better yet, let us render homage to one who has been insufficiently recognized for the noble role he played in advancing the cause of freedom and equality in this nation. Although he was the son of a president, the nation's sixth president, and a noted jurist and diplomat, it was as a congressman that John Quincy Adams wrote some of the most inspiring chapters of American history, as he singly, courageously, and stubbornly warred against slavery in the fateful decades before the Civil War. He was a defender of the rights of man. He was just and tenacious in purpose. He endured, and his example illuminates. He must not be forgotten. My guest today is William Lee Miller, author of Arguing About Slavery, published by Vintage Books. Bill, welcome to Dialogue.
Very glad to be here, George.
Bill, your book is a recreation of an epic 9-year battle centered on the issue of slavery, conducted in the United States Congress and led by the remarkable John Quincy Adams. Bill, to give us a context, could you help us understand the nature of slavery in the early 19th century? I mean by that, was it more than simply a Southern institution in a smaller and fragile nation?
Well, it had been back just at the time of the Revolution. All the colonies had some slavery. And the impulse of the Revolution led to the abolition of slavery in the northern states, so that it then became the peculiar institution of the states in the South. And the period of this book, it comes to be, begin to be a real political issue. The nation is forming. It's still young. John Quincy Adams, as you say, is the son of a participant in the major right. participant in the Revolution. His father had left their home in Quincy and gone down to Philadelphia in 1774. He'd been the Atlas of Independence. John Quincy and his mother, the famous Abigail, would sit with the original copy of the Declaration of Independence at their dinner table in Braintree. And John Quincy himself was a teenager as these events are happening.
Exactly.
He's carrying letters from Abigail to John to the post office on his horse when he's 12 years old.
This is going to come into our story at various points, but it's important for us now and for all listening to understand this man was a living link to the very founding of our republic. And here he is at another pivotal era acting in Congress now, and this is interesting, too, because he becomes a congressman after he's been president.
That's right. That is unique. Mm-hmm. He had an enormous career, a career perhaps not even matched by Jefferson. I mean, he'd been a state senator. He'd been a Massachusetts senator. He'd been appointed and approved as a justice of the Supreme Court, which he turned down. He'd been ambassador to almost every major capital in Europe you could name. Mm-hmm. And he'd been president of the United States. And he's in his early 60s, which was older then than it is now. And he's just had a tragic death of his oldest son. And you would have thought he would have done what the first five presidents did, which is to retire, in the case of the Virginians, to their big houses, and in the case of the Adams, to their medium-sized houses, and be a kind of elder statesman and participate occasionally. But he didn't do that. He went back to Massachusetts, and they asked him whether he would run for Congress. He ran, and he served for 17 years after he'd been president of the United States in the House of Representatives.
Bill, to give us a sense of mood and attitude, let me ask you this question, because we're going to contrast the forces that were for slavery and the abolitionist forces that were growing at this time against slavery, and then, of course, the great mass that might have been indifferent or going either way. But there's a phrase in the book that might help, and I'd like to get you to expound on it. I think at one point you write that as this comes to a head, slavery on the part of slaveholders was an interest, and on the part of those who were going to oppose it, it was a sentiment.
Correct.
And so there's a real disparity there.
That's right. That's a good quotation from the historian Don Fehrenbacher, the late Don Fehrenbacher died a year ago. And although most of the founders were opposed to slavery, Abraham Lincoln could refer to them all, they didn't have the same – it didn't rank as high in the things they cared about as did slavery for those for whom slavery was your fortune. Mm-hmm. If you're a slaveholder holding 200 slaves on a big plantation, that's your wealth. And when somebody attacks that, they're attacking your economic standing. I say somewhere in the book that you think of something today that would be morally reprehensible, but that's built into the society with lots of people's careers and their fortunes and their family standing tied to it. Tobacco is not a bad illustration. Think how hard it is to win victories over tobacco. Well, slavery was 10 times as hard.
That's good. It's an excellent comparison. I mean, one has to, there's a proportionality to think about there, but yeah, depth of feeling about it.
That's right. Of course, there were other ingredients in slavery. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of guilt that you really did, somewhere deep in you, you knew that this wasn't what you should be doing, so that made you all the more. Part of what I do in the book is to quote these fellows, the slaveholders, and the defensiveness and the obsessive. The fact that they would oppose even the slightest threat, and that led them to do things that hurt their own side, really.
That's a good point for me to emphasize right now, because one of the great strengths of this book is the direct quotation. I mean, one feels almost eavesdropping on conversations and statements by these people. And the defensiveness of the slaveholders is striking. It's also, I must confess, extraordinarily offensive, even 150 years after the fact. I mean, to have things turned on their heads and slavery presented at one point as being a bastion of equality.
Absolutely. That was very common. Orwellian, I call it.
Yeah.
You know, slavery is the basis of freedom. We're freer in the South with our slave society. Of course, you ask, who's we exactly? But, what you're thinking is, we white folk in the South are freer than you in the North are because we have the slavery as a base, and Athens had slavery, and you had a whole elaborate mythology of chivalry built around it. But specifically, freedom, you claimed, as a value that it protected. And the other half of the house would laugh when sometimes
you
get laughter from, when they presented that argument. Mm. But yes, that is one of the things I wanted to do, to let you hear the voices of these folk. And it's not only the arguments, but also the deeds. I mean, the central action on which this book turns is a gag rule in the house, which says, we will not accept a petition on the subject of slavery. Mm-hmm. Now, you think that over. You've got all the heritage of petition of freedom.
Right.
But you can't on that subject. Well, that's an insult. I mean, if you had been Dick Morris or some political consultant today, you would have said, don't do that. Don't hand them the issue of civil liberty in addition to the issue of slavery.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is the crux of our story. There is going to be a gag rule, as you point out, imposed in Congress, prohibiting discussion of the issue of slavery on the floor of the Congress. And as you also point out, the instigating factor had been petitions, or would-be petitions, arriving from citizens throughout the country, mainly from the North, presented on the floor of the Congress to raise this issue. I want to dwell on these kinds of points to set this thing in further context with you, Bill. First of all, how important to this entire story is the fact that it takes place in the palace of representative Republican government?
Well, this was even more the center. We should think of it as one of the centers of our government today. But in the mind of the founders and of the people behind, the forefathers of our forefathers, the House of Commons was coming to be in England the center, and this is the people's house, as even in this century Gerald Ford said. And, of course, at that time, the Senate is chosen by state legislatures. They tend to be a different order. But this is the one place where in each district somebody is elected and represents the people. So that and in addition to that, the level of attention you could give to it. You didn't have the competing.
Right.
This was what you talked about. This is what newspapers – there's several things coming together in the 1830s. You have a new penny press. You have a very literate population. It's one in the North, at least, one of the most literate populations in the world. You read these newspapers. You read your congressman's speeches in a way you wouldn't think of doing today. I say somewhere the paper is the equivalent of today's C-SPAN. You could follow these debates, and you'd hear them, and you'd respond to them.
C-SPAN without competition.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How crucial here is this age-old right of petition? I mean, for a modern audience who may not be even that familiar with the term anymore, what is petition, and how important was it, and how extraordinary is it to have it banned in the way that's going to be banned here.
Let me ask you first of all, indirectly, can you name the five to anybody listening? Can you name the five freedoms guaranteed in the First Amendment? You can name three of them quickly, but then you find the right to assemble and the right to petition. You don't name as quickly as you do the other three. But people at this time, that went back through the heritage of republicanism. If you mention in your speeches, as you would the Magna Carta, if you mention the Petition of Right, these are events in English history which you appropriate for American history. And then in the colonial days, you petitioned the king, And that was a right which expressed what the government was all about. You can't tell some citizen that he can't ask those who are serving him in the role, now not of king, but of a member of a legislative body, to send some petition saying, please do this. And so that when they stamped on that, when they said, no, you can't petition on this subject, they did give hand to John Quincy Adams and the other opponents another issue, which Adams exploited to the hilt.
Let me use this date, Bill. You tell me if I've got the right one. I gathered from my reading of the book that this is at least one point of detonation, if we may use that phrase. 16th day of December, 1835, a certain John Fairfield of Maine introduces a petition from citizens of Maine. I guess largely women, that's another important factor, women who cannot
vote. Actually, that was all women.
All women. Who, of course, in those 8 days could not vote, but would pronounce themselves through petitions on this issue, calling for the emancipation of slaves in the District of Columbia. Enormous consternation and outrage among Southern members of Congress on this issue. First of all, why that outrage and that consternation and deep feeling? And secondly, why this focus on the District of Columbia?
To answer the last point first, think of the situation. The district, the answer that the people from South Carolina or Georgia would give you was, well, this was part of the deal when we made the nation. Slavery was already a part of our society. It's part of the bond, so you can't attack it. And even the abolitionists who are then forming admit that under the present arrangements, you can't attack slavery in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But in the district didn't exist, and the district is for everybody. It's as much the capital for Massachusetts and Pennsylvania as it is for, so that's the Achilles heel of slavery. They're classically educated, and John C. Calhoun will say it's the Thermopylae of, they'd learned these classical references. The point at which the thing is joined is whether the nation's capital, of course, the handful, it's a small group that opposes slavery. But those who do point out the paradox, the irony of having where the flag of freedom flies, then you had slave trading at that time in the District of Columbia with all that went with that, with coffles of slaves and chains being led not far from the Capitol and with a slave market a few blocks away and so forth. So that was a scandal to people from Vermont.
Yeah.
Who didn't have any memory of that, and Oklahoma was a real shock to actually see it.
Well, Vermont, in fact, was the first state to prohibit slavery, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, it came into the Union without slavery. It's the first state not to have had slavery.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I guess, Bill, that in addition to, as you pointed out earlier, feeling their rights of property so deeply threatened in this way, slaveholders, particularly in the year 1835, I'm thinking we're also mindful of things like Nat Turner and
that's
the votes,
right.
and the possibility of insurrection and
that's
so forth.
That's right. The 1830s are the time that all this starts, and you'd had two things happened in 1831. One was the Nat Turner revolt, in which the thing that was fearful in Southern and slaveholders' imagination that there'd be a, as they called it, a servile revolt, that these slaves would join together, and of course, they're enormous numbers now. You're talking about a major fraction of the nation, and particularly then in places like coastal South Carolina, they're majorities, and that they would have an actual revolt, and that some white people would be killed is one fearful thing. And there were threatened and rumors of other conspiracies. There were events in the Caribbean, which you now have in your imagination. The other thing that happened was the founding of The Liberator by William Lloyd Garrison is published in 1831. And sometimes historians put those two things together. You now have a nationally circulated journal, which is unequivocally, immediate abolition of slavery. There'd been an older form of abolitionism, if you put it that way, of opposing slavery. Mm-hmm. but it was tied to the colonization idea, which you could interpret. It could either be anti-slavery or it could be some other things. You can. Right. So it was the genteel form of opposing slavery, but the immediate said, no, it's a sin and it should be stopped right now.
Bill, there's lots to talk to you about. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is William Lee Miller, Thomas C. Sorensen Professor of Political and Social Thought at the University of Virginia, and author of Arguing About Slavery, published by Vintage Books. Bill, it's time to introduce the protagonist of our story now, because he is in Congress after being president. It's John Quincy Adams, of course, who may have had, did have the most extraordinary pedigree of, I think, any American leader. What manner of man was he? Because I think everything hinges here on the character of this extraordinary person.
Well, he was a man who had been imbued from his youth with the ideals of the Republic. I mean, think of being the son of John Adams and of Abigail Adams. You have two parents who are articulate, intelligent, participants in the revolution and in the ideals of the revolution. They're among the ones who first articulate what the American Revolution is going to stand for. And they're in the two centers, the key point, they're in Boston and Philadelphia, which are the two centers of where the action is, if our modern phrase. John Quincy is a teenager absorbing all this, then goes to Europe and carries the message when his father is carrying out various European duties. And he sort of defends the New Republic and sees it defended in that setting, comes back and himself gets involved and has this enormous career. He's appointed by every president except Jefferson. He would have been appointed by Jefferson if they hadn't had a little squabble with the Adams and Jefferson's families, and serves an enormous role. And he's a scholar, but he's not a. And he's a lawyer. He has a law degree, and he briefly serves as a lawyer. But he's a public servant, and he's imbued with the idea that he should serve the nation, and he should serve the nation's ideals. It's not just tribal. It's not just this is my nation, therefore I will serve it. It is that this country stands for something. Mm-hmm. So then he can, and he has a kind of prestige. If Adams hadn't been picked up on this petition fight, this gag rule fight, it wouldn't have gone anywhere because the other eight or nine were backbenchers, to put it in a British term. They were not major figures. But here's the 67, 68, 69-year-old ex-president of the United States, son of John Adams, sitting there in the front row of the House. You can't ignore him. Right. And he wants to speak, right. And when he speaks, you have to pay attention. And he doesn't mince words. He's not. There's sometimes people think people get more conservative as they get older. Mm-hmm. Not in his case. I mean, he is very blunt, even to the point of some sarcasm. The Southerners, the slaveholders, are orators. They have this tradition of verbal performance. Mm-hmm. But John Quincy can match them, can give them as good as he gets.
Yeah. He is, in every sense, not just an old man eloquent, he's called, but he's more than that. He's a feisty warrior is what he is. I mean, if for no other reason, if you just wanted to read a spirited form of argument, the book would be worthwhile just to see the way that he comes back time and time again. Unpopularity does not bother him. Attacks don't bother him. They seem to inspire him to constantly push against this gag rule on petitions. Now, as he does this, Bill, and of course the heart of the story is this, the repeated attempts made by John Quincy Adams and a few others to try to push back this extraordinary gag. I mean, it is literally extraordinary to think that Congress would have this kind of thing, have a gag rule against slavery. But does our story get complicated by other things that are happening in this very era? That is to say, American expansionism, the fact that territories are being acquired. Texas, in particular, is going to be a major focus of this
issue. That's right. Those who know Texas history know 1836 is an important time, and then in almost 10 years later, Texas is actually annexed, and Texas becomes this independent country from Mexico. And ironically, Mexico had in 1829, at least formally, abolished slavery. Then when Texas becomes independent with a lot of Americans who'd come there with their slaves, and then when it is annexed, think of this. The Empire of Liberty, in Jefferson's good phrase, becomes the agent of turning this back from freedom to slavery. Well, Adams at this point, he had been back when he was Secretary of State, he had been one who wanted to annex Texas when the slavery issue wasn't in the forefront. But now he's joined the abolitionists felt, mm-hmm. how rightly or wrongly historians will debate, that the big push was to increase the number of slave states. You could have as many as 5 states made out of the territory of Texas. That's 10 senators. Mm-hmm. That means you're home free. Yeah. And then you talk about further expansion, the territories of Mexico in southern, so that they would be slave territories. And that's part of what the abolitionists are very much opposed to, the annexation of Texas, because they see it in terms of this slavery battle. And that, as you say, that runs through and, mm-hmm. and is involved in this whole fight.
Now, Bill, this whole fight is the better part of a decade, almost an entire decade. Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of it, after a great deal of travail, some of which we'll get into in a moment, the forces to repeal the gag rule prevail.
That's right. They finally win.
They finally win. And I guess the question is, what have they won? I mean, what's the effect of this once that happens? What does it mean in the context of what we know is going to happen 21 years later?
Well, it does mean that you can discuss slavery. It does mean that then when you talk about the territories acquired in the Mexican War, David Wilmot can introduce a proviso that says, I mean, you can discuss slavery. Mm-hmm. You receive petitions. So slavery is now opened up as a topic in the center of the government. Now, that doesn't mean the fight they move back to another stage. Mm-hmm. The Southerners now try to keep the speakership so they can appoint the committees so that when petitions are sent to committee, we can have them come mm-hmm. out right, so that you keep moving the battle back to a new line.
But kind of presages the Dixiecrats in a way.
Yeah, that's right. It is a major, to some degree symbolically mm-hmm. and to some degree really, a major victory in opening up mm-hmm. the possibility, mm-hmm. Which, you know, people would say, well, it should never have been closed. But it's the fact that they would go so far as right. to interfere with basic civil liberties. You see, think if you're somebody who's not all that northern white person, not all that opposed to slavery, but when somebody tells you you can't sign a petition on this topic, that gets you in a different way. Yeah. So that as Adams keeps using the fact that you're annoyed at the presumption, mm-hmm. you're beginning to build a picture of what will then come to be called in the 1850s a slave power. Once you're beginning to think conspiratorially, if you will, but you're beginning to think of a great phalanx that's going to hurt me as a northern white man. Because of their power in government, because of the things that they will do, which the gag rule is a potent example. Yeah. And that then leads to the events of the 1850s, which lead on to the Civil War.
What a story. And the best way to get the full story is to read Arguing About Slavery, which I heartily recommend to everybody listening. Bill, to conclude this conversation, I certainly hope we have many others, I want to ask you a couple of questions that occurred to me after I read the book. I know you've also written about Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
And, of course, one of the things that quickly entered my mind was, in our modern-day context, he's perhaps a president who's had an afterlife in terms of human rights, and who, of course, even as president, was concerned with that issue, and as I say, leaving office has gone on to do other things. Did any of those parallels occur to you as you
Yes.
thought about
at one
men?
Point, I thought I was people were talking to me about giving a presentation at a public affairs group. I thought of announcing the greatest ex-president without saying who it was, mm-hmm. and then have a little initial discussion of who do you think is the greatest ex-president. Of course, my answer is you know what it's going to mm-hmm. be. It's going to be John Quincy, and a lot of people don't know this story. Part of the reason I wrote this is to bring it out. But Carter would be the modern candidate, maybe Herbert Hoover had quite an ex-presidency. And, of course, this would be very controversial, but people who would still support Richard Nixon would say he had a long period. Mm-hmm. None of these people served in an elective governmental position, so they didn't go into the center of power mm-hmm. as John Quincy did, nor was it as long, nor was it quite as pivotal in national affairs as what Adams did.
What is this story, and there's another thing that I thought of in putting the book down. What does it tell us about the weight of citizen action? Because at some point, that sheer is that one of the abolitionists mentioned, just getting so many petitions there that the table would break becomes a factor. And that's a very peculiar kind of American way, I would think, of bringing things to bear.
That's right. Of course, in those days, you didn't have telegrams to your congressman. You didn't have PACs. You didn't have polls. You didn't have polls. Think of that. You know, so that how what are people? What is the citizenry thinking? This is supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people. and you talk that language, all of these people, including the those defending slavery in the South, talk the language of republicanism, by which they meant government by the people. Mm-hmm. And this was a key instrument then. Mm-hmm. So it's really, in some ways, it's a symbol of what this kind of a government is about.
Yeah.
And so then telling the story of when it was really threatened is, mm-hmm. is something we can learn from.
Finally, Bill Miller, this question. This is a question I guess I had in my head somewhere from maybe page, oh, who knows what page, but early on in the book, straight through to the end of it, that this was a man about whom I was reading, President of the United States, who, to my mind, has not been given his due recognition as president, as an inspiring American leader. I would like to get your comment on that as a historian, as an author, as a scholar. Where does this man belong in our pantheon?
Hmm. As you imply, higher than he has been rated. One of the reasons he's not is that his presidency was not the height of his accomplishment. Now, that means he was, and he had only 4 years. There are only two presidents in the first set who don't serve two terms, and their names are both Adams. It's he and his father. Serve one term and then they're out. It wasn't successful presidency because the Jacksonian movement was already gathering and was opposing him on everything he tried. He proposed some very interesting things, a national university, for example, and lots of ambitious national undertakings. But the Jacksonians just beat that into the ground. They were states' rights people, and they, there were other reasons they opposed it. So that's one reason. He rates, he should be right. When they have these polls, they always say of the presidents. Well, you know, you ask it in a better way, not where do the presidents rate, but who are these national leaders? He's one of a handful of the greatest leaders and greater than many other people who are rated higher in their presidential term mm-hmm. than he might be. And he is right up there next after the founders and Lincoln, I would say.
I'd put him there too. And quite frankly, another thing that I took as a reader away from this book was that in this era where we are witnessing, and perhaps I speak here with some hope, a renewed emphasis on human rights, even in recent days and weeks, we've seen some rather striking things that may pay out. It's important to know stories like this, stories of courage and stories of people standing up for principle and ultimately, happily, winning out. Mm-hmm. Bill Miller, thank you for telling us this story.
Thank you for having me, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was William Lee Miller, author of Arguing About Slavery, published by Vintage Books. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is the nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at RadioDial. That's RadioDial at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.